a certain senator in Washington. He was getting goodbye with murder. And to clinch a point, he would make his own statement, but he said, as Socrates said, and it wasn't Socrates ever said at all, but this would impress the senator. One bird looked up some of those quotations and he found they never said them at all. But he knew that there are people be impressed if he quoted Pericles, Socrates, Plato, or some obscure scientist, and a lot of people just like that. When I was a student, not a student, I studied at Chicago University, preaching at Chicago Theological Seminary. Palmer was the president, and your sermons are criticized by the students. Every sermon I had to begin with, they criticized, too simple, too obvious. Didn't have profundity to it, wasn't scholarly, and all that sort of thing. So one day, I got a hold of Professor Wieman's book. He was the leading professor in logic and philosophy at the university at the time. One of his books, and I memorized about two whole pages. And I put that into the sermon. That just for the Dickens, I would see what happened. Same thing. Too simple, too obvious. Only the President Palmer knew about it. And he had a good chuckle and laugh about it afterwards. It shows you how people form conclusions with the feeling that they got to be. And as I suspect lots of times with theological, I like to poke fun at them because I think so highly of them. But too often times, it's profound if it's muddy. If people can't understand it, then it is really something. I think I read to you the other day, the Gettysburg Address. The opening sentence, paragraph, and should convey the idea that you have serious business at hand. This is not something trivial. Isn't you not filling time? And be careful that you don't make the mistake of betting the hours against the centuries. That's a quotation from Emerson. Never make the mistake, he said, of betting the hours against the centuries, of getting wrapped up in the temporary and forgetting the long-range things. In the body of the sermon, have you ever noticed how much fun it's to diagnose a thing and take it apart? Diagnosis is, in many ways, the easiest thing, and it is a lot of fun. A doctor can diagnose an ailment, saying, here's the temperature, here's the conditions, here's the blood count, this is what happens. Yeah, but what's the solution? That's the important thing. Diagnosis is like a play. Intriguing play that you look at. How is it going to end? And you wait for the denouement of the play. And this is the most difficult part of any sermon, is the last third. That's the hardest part of a sermon, to make it significant. Where are we going? The people are saying, what, so what? And there has to be some significant conclusion that the people feel that this is what we must do about it. The application is the most difficult. Of course, it's always easy to offer solutions. I think of Will Rogers in World War I. A lot of people are complaining about the German submarine sinking our ships. Why, he said in his humorous way. Nothing to that, he said. It's very simple. They said, why? Well, he said, all you need to do is drain the Atlantic Ocean. Somebody said, well, how are you going to do that? Well, he said, that's your problem. He said, I've given you the solution. And so lots of times, it's very easy to say this is what to do. The most difficult is the last third. And you have to be careful that though the sermon does apply, it's not personal. And you don't have a grudge. Watch out so your feelings don't get in the sermon too. You've been sick during the week. Don't make the sermon sick. In a parish where one of my brothers was a minister or member, the minister was always preaching negative sermons. He was denouncing the youth. He was denouncing labor. He was denouncing his sermons are negative. He suddenly became ill, and he found that he'd had quite a tumor for some time. He was operated on. It was a benign tumor. He recovered, and his sermons changed completely. They took on a different tone. My brother said they became optimistic, cheerful. He began to see the joy of the Christian religion. We are affected how we feel. We are affected. Wadsworth said, I didn't enjoy the Alps. I had a poor breakfast. Mm-hmm. And so we can be affected by what we eat, what we do, how we feel. Some of them people will say, you
tell you that they don't want dogmatic sermons. Don't get excited. That isn't really what they mean. They just don't want dry sermons, that's all. You can't preach a sermon without dogma in it. Even the simplest one will have some kind of a dogma in it. But it's just they don't like to see the skeleton. God, when he made us, didn't put the bones on the outside. He covered it with the flesh and blood. And so it is with our preaching of dogma. And then I was too simple to make the division between law and gospel. I just preach the text and let the law and gospel fit in where it can. By that I mean is, if you preach the parable and tell the parable and preach it to the people, the division takes care of itself. Some ministers feel I got a 50% law, 50% gospel. When I preach the law, now I got to preach the gospel. You can't split Jesus that way. I think that you just present it in the law and the gospel. Maybe one teeny sentence in your sermon may hook into a person, and it carries with them through the rest of the day. As we get older, as you may have discovered, we tend to talk too much. And give the people tangible things to do. Brethren, what shall we do? They came to Peter after the sermon. What are the tangible things we can do? When you're young, it's easy to be denunciatory. I can think of some of the sermons I've preached, and I began denouncing the evils of the day, and I thought I'd settle them all. I'm surprised they were still there. In your preparation, I've already mentioned to read your text over, read a number of translations. I use the harmony of the Gospels quite a bit to find what is said in different places. I write down everything I can think of. I have at my left in my desk the sermon that is to be preached the coming Sunday. Then I have another one called Coming Sermons. And as I'm reading, as I'm thinking, I throw stuff in the hopper. When the week comes, on about Tuesday, I will take a sheet of paper and write down everything that comes to me. No connection at all, perhaps, with the sermon, but any idea that writes down, I start working on it. And then on the next day, maybe in the morning, maybe late in the evening, I spend another couple hours pulling it together. And I say, what is it that you really want to say in the sermon? What is it that you want to say? Well, I want to say, if a Christian is a Christian, there'll be wings to his faith and not weight. All right, then see to it that you distinguish between, I'm talking to myself. That's the way I'm doing in the sermon, I talk to myself. I know a minister who paces back and forth and has a stand. He doesn't sit when he prepares a sermon. He paces back and forth, talking out loud, writes down notes, goes back and forth, comes back, writes something down, and it creates in his imagination the text. Then identify yourself with the text, if you can, in your imagination. Identify yourself. Don't be afraid of repetition or simplicity. Never overestimate there. Never underestimate their intelligence. Never overestimate their knowledge. They have a capacity to think as well as you have. And in confirmation class, I treat my children as adults, not as little children. Well, prepare your people for the sermon by, as I say, what you say. Now the mechanics of preaching. Tone of voice. Employ inflection. Go into the church and read the Psalms or anything you wish, and exaggerate the inflections. Like, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Now, it's crazy, it sounds crazy, but you'll note the inflections that come. Children are natural in their inflections. What is this? This is a book. You notice the change? I didn't say, what is this? This is a book. Nothing will put people to sleep faster than a nice, steady, droning voice, musical and sweet. I remember a fellow who finished the seminary about the time I was at, he had one of the most melodious voices I ever heard. But try as I never could listen through a sermon of his. His sweet, melodious voice just puts you under. Inflections in your voice, use of pauses, enunciate. Enunciate distinctly every word that you speak. You can speak rapidly, but if you enunciate, the people will hear it. And then your pantomime. your face, your hands. They should be alive. Don't have a deadpan face when you get up there. Your eyes should be alive. In other words, you're burning energy when you preach. You must burn energy when you preach. Not by shouting or jumping, but there has to be an emotional intensity of which the congregation is aware. And in your gestures, don't be waving your arms all over the place. And if you're a big man, this is particularly bad. You're big to begin with, and if you have these big arms swooping around like a crane up there, it doesn't have any particular effect. And then, don't overwork a gesture. This is where you need the help of your wife. Again and again, I've been corrected on gestures. I'm left-handed, so I have a tendency to use the left hand. Strike a balance in the use of your gestures or your face. And then watch out for shouting. As you've heard it said, ministers shout when the point is weak. I don't think that's true. I think we do it more or less as we get into the habit. Now, any comment? I've raced through this pretty fast. Incidentally, I make a prayer at the end of my sermon too. And this applies to the sermon. What is in the sermon? And the prayer after the prayer of the church, I don't always take that. And I will take parts of it that may fit. When we're disturbed about Vietnam, I'll bring in the prayer of nations and peace. But many times I leave out the whole prayer. I feel after the sermon it should move swiftly to its conclusion, the whole service. I want them to go out in that mood. That's why I like the idea of the creed at the end of the sermon, and then the hymn, and then they go on their way.
I don't know how many use the general prayer, but I've gotten away from it, that I very seldom use it.
It's pretty long.
That's the thing I found most criticized by all types of lay people.
Is that so?
Seems to be.
I've got a special request. Don't use that verse. So we use all different kinds. I've had them revise it and had women say one part. I use this thing a few times instead of amen. Use yes and other terms on there. Mm-hmm. And they kind of perk up, you know. Oh, yeah. You know, rather than the soporific effect of having going through.
The altar prayer book is tremendous, too. It's got some fabulous general prayers in it. The regular altar prayer book, I don't know how new it is, but we've had it for about a year and a half now, and our people have remarked of how meaningful those prayers are. Of course, they're completely different every Sunday, so they're never the same.
May I have a comment?
Yeah.
There is a congregation in Madison that has, I think, without a doubt, solve all your problems as far as writing a sermon, at least preparing it and so forth. They write the sermon for the pastor. They have set up a committee of about five men from the congregation. And after about 3 weeks of being there, they didn't like his sermons. So they sat down and said, well, we'll write your sermons for you. We'll tell you how to present it. You get up there and do it. That's a little different.
I wouldn't recommend it. They could just throw a tape recorder and then have him go out fishing.
Yes.
Seems to me there's no personality in it.
That's how they get along.
That reminds me of the minister who was preaching. His notes, and the wind came in and blew all his notes out the window. And he said to the congregation, from this point on, I'll have to rely on the Holy Spirit. Afterwards, one of the members said, Pastor, you did a lot better than the Holy Spirit. The preparation of the sermon is a chore. And you never escape it. If you think as you get older it gets easier, it doesn't. I work and sweat and toil, seems to me, as much. I know something's going to come, which I didn't know when I began. I remember the first few months in the ministry, I thought I'd preach everything I'd ever know. What am I going to say now? And I'd work on a paragraph and write and sweat, and it'd take another 5 hours to get another paragraph and so on. But now you know that it will come, but you still have to hammer at it.
Have you looked back at old sermons of when you're younger and wonder, what little child did this? Plural ideas that you thought were tremendous, you know.
It's a good thing to listen to your sermon on tape recording. I've done that many times. But I always found that I had to wait till Tuesday. I couldn't stand to listen to it on Monday. You became so aware of the mistakes, the transitions, and everything. You could be much less involved in it on Tuesday.
Do any of you practice with tape recordings prior to your preaching?
With what?
Practice with a tape recorder.
I've done a little of it, but I never could get too much benefit out of it.
But do you find it difficult having to preach the same sermon three or four times in a row?
That is very difficult.
To work up the same thing as if it's fresh and alive?
That is very difficult. As a rule, my sermons, when I preach two or three, they change quite a bit.
Yeah.
There's only way I can keep reasonably fresh.
Have you usually had a dual service schedule?
Most of the time, yes. I change it when I came where I am. They had two services in Westchester when I came there, but the church was only a third filled both times. And as cold as could be, the congregation, they had this crazy, maybe some of you do too, but I still think it's crazy whether you do or not. And that is the regimentation of the people after services. They had the ushers march right down, and each aisle marched out. And if you stood and visited any length with somebody coming out about something, people had to sit there until you, it's the coldest way in my opinion. I encourage the people to visit after church. Sit around, stand around, have a cup of coffee in the patio. If they want to go out the side door, what door they want to go out to go home, many of them do.
Well, how about visiting right in the church right afterwards, in the aisles and that
sort of thing? Do that too, don't know. Yeah. Now when they have it this way, I did discontinue the... They'll go out side doors, other doors, and the church is empty in a hurry. Fill the large patio with people standing there visiting. And then people who have some particular problem or something want to see the minister about, they corner me and come over to me.
But you don't go to the door then?
I go to the door and shake hands, but the most of them go out different doors and then see me out there in front. And I have my secretary standing right beside me all the time. So if somebody comes along and says, Pastor, I'd like to arrange your baptism, or Pastor, we'd like to join your church, I say, please give the name to the secretary, and then I can go on to the next person.
We've had a lot of discussion on that at our church. We've tried it both ways, and there seems to be those who want to leave the sanctuary in a spirit of worship. As soon as they leave it, then they're free to go back and have coffee and meet in the fireside room and everything else. And there are others who would rather just leave without any formal dismissal. And we really have gone round and round on this. Right now we are dismissed in that way, the ushers.
Yeah, I went to a church in Detroit Lakes, my wife and I, where they dismissed a mile by aisle. We came in, ushered way down the front, and first thing you know, we were out in the street and on our way home. I didn't meet anybody, see anybody. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of these gregarious critters. I like to meet people. But other people around the way, maybe that's what it should be, but I'd like to think of the church as a family. And that's one time they get together. How are your kids? How are they recovering from the measles? And why isn't Jim here in church today? All that conversation that takes place. Any other suggestions, comments?
One thing you mentioned, when you've been in the ministry 10 years, you change your pattern of sermonizing. Mm-hmm. I've heard others say this, and I've heard them say to me as a young pastor that after some years this happens. And now as I look back, it happened to me. It dramatically changed my whole sermonizing program. It's different as night and day from what I was doing up to 10 years, and I didn't change it. I didn't plan, well, I've been in 10 years, now I'm going to change it.
No.
It didn't happen this way. It's completely the opposite. Do you find this is normal?
I think it is. What naturally happens, our life expands, we get new interests, We move out of the skeptical second period in life into the more mature, and we begin to evaluate things, and we our words carry more weight. I think it does change distinctly. I have never used, and I don't look at notes when I preach. I preach from memory, not the sentences, but the ideas. I think I'd have a little difficulty in using notes. Not that that's the only way. Some men preach effectively with notes. Some read their sermon completely. Fosdick read his sermons. I went up in his pulpit, and at a sloping pulpit, he could look at those notes and look at you at the same time. Did a remarkable job of it. Very effective.
Well, this is an example of how dramatically it changed. If I ever came to a Saturday and didn't have my sermon written out, I could be a sick boy by Saturday night. Mm-hmm. It really affected me. At about 10 years in the ministry, a sudden change where I don't write my sermon till 4 o'clock Sunday morning. I'll get up at that time and I'll write my sermon. This is a dramatic change.
That's right. And it's you and it fits you.
But it didn't before.
No, Mark Grubdow told me he has a sermon all prepared when Saturday comes, and Saturday night he goes to a movie. He said he wants to get away from any thought of the sermon. So he'll go to an interesting movie. He wants to get his mind away from it completely. I remember hearing a noticed minister in New York say, Sunday morning he got up before everybody did. He went down to the street corner, had his breakfast, didn't talk to anybody, then went over to the church and he saw nobody or talked to anyone until he stepped into the pulpit. That was his procedure. I think we all develop certain techniques to our own taste and flavor. But go and listen to different preachers whenever you can. Not to be critical, but say to yourself, what makes that man tick? Is it his personality? Is it the material? Is it the warmth in his personality? Then take a look at yourself. I've heard an immense number of preachers, and I've listened to street corner preachers. I've gone in Hyde Park in London, Columbus Circle in New York, and listened to these screwballs, nuts, and all these different people. They've got something. They hold the audience. They may be nuts, but they've got something. There's an interesting thing about the English that I'll tell you. I'm sure some of you have been to Hyde Park where they can go out and say anything they want in this place. They get a box and stand on it. They can condemn the king, curse the president, promote atheism. There's one man that was cursing who believed they should kill the king. And the crowd was getting bigger and they're going over to the sidewalk. And the police come along leisurely, and one of the policemen said, now, all you who want to kill the king, if you get on this side, and those who don't on the other side, so you get That's the English.
Well, we want to thank you very much for sharing your time with us. As we're leaving, I suppose we won't have a chance to be together as a group. This has been very meaningful. You shared of yourself, not only of the techniques, but I think the whole flavor of your life has communicated itself and has been very meaningful to us. And we wish you God's blessings in your ministry.
Thank you.
And all that is before you, on the books that you have on the hopper. Hope they get out into the fire.
I've been hesitant about writing because I feel I'm a speaker and not a writer, and there are two different techniques. S. Parks Cadden, the great preacher in the turn of the century, his books are dull as can be to read. Nobody reads them. But his sermons were magnetic to listen to him. He somehow made every one of those words leap alive. I think as ministers, as a rule, we develop as speakers rather than writers. It takes a different vocabulary to make something effective on paper. Many times, as you have to look at your sermon afterwards, and you feel, man, that sure wasn't much of a sermon. But I hope to be able, what I'd like to do is have time enough to write a book on As I See Religion Today. from what I sought when I began in 1923. And also the importance of the minister. This is a thing I see more and more. Well, we haven't heard from the laity. She's been awful quiet over there. And Paul?
Well, one thing I think is quite kind of interesting to me, and I'll go to service or something like this, and I'll know that maybe a pastor, I'm just going to the church. I have to be in the location of the town, or the school or something like this. And the minister will have a mediocre sermon. Or else maybe hit 5 points and never really develop any one of them. I know one pastor that I think a real lot of, I think he's a very, very fine person, but he's an awful lousy speaker. But the thing is that it's a large congregation, and a lot of times you don't get a good close relationship with a pastor. But yet at the same time, you want to say, well, I wish I could help him. I wish I could point something out. I think a lot of people are afraid to go up and say, well, you dwelled on one point too long, or you brought 5 points off, but I didn't get anything out of any one of those 5 points. How can you tactfully criticize or constructively criticize a sermon? I think this is one thing that maybe, I don't know, how do you feel? Would you rather have someone say something about your sermon?
Sure.
But that's why you're here.
Yes. We want to hear you. Yeah.
Well, I have three things I'd like to say. One is, I made up my mind to come and listen to this when I heard you gentlemen on the boat talking that it was going to be, I asked what you were going to do here. And they said, well, we're going to learn a little more about preaching, or how to improve our preaching or something. And so I came because I must confess that I'm probably very critical of pastors and have been for several years. So I thought maybe if I sat in on this that it would give me some insight into what they're thinking and maybe humble me in my approach to the pastors. And this it has helped in many forms. The other two observations, one came when you were discussing grief. And from my own personal experience, I'd like to emphasize the feeling that I have of a need for freedom for grief. I was engaged to a fellow when I was younger who died of cancer. And the thought from the pastor and from most people was that there should not be grief because the boy was suffering, and therefore it was a blessing that he died. Well, in my mind, he was a whole man first, and that the suffering was not the important thing to me, but that he died. And if I was to be grief-stricken, I was almost, not quite, but almost unchristian. And I've spent about 15 years with migraine headaches, which started about 6 months after his boy's death. And I feel that this isn't the whole thing, but that partly I was not committed to have any genuine grief. And so I plead for freedom for grief, and I think the pastor can give the greatest freedom because you can free us for this. My third observation is quite different, and I've learned this from associating with pastors' wives, both young, but mostly middle-aged ones, rather than the younger ones. And this is to remember that the wives were not here getting renewed, that they are at home in the normal routine, and that if you could bring back to them at least three of the most significant ideas that you've gained and that you're mulling over, then they become a part of this and that they get self-renewal too, besides making them a part of your life. And maybe two incidents that you think are strictly would be of interest to them as women. There's some comments that he made about women, which might help them and give them a tiny bit of self-renewal. Because I think that sometimes they really don't get the same kind of renewal or fellowship that you gentlemen get from each other. So I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Very good comment. Very good. Thank you.
Recently started the practice of writing a modern parable and including it in the service, following the creed prior to the sermon hymn, that ties up the scripture and hopefully what's going to come, you know, from the sermon. And I found a tremendous amount of freedom here. You can, like last Sunday, I preached on two peanuts in a shell and how the two peanuts grew, and when they matured, they began, all they could do, they couldn't go anywhere, just simply talk to one another. And then the day came when the shell was shattered by the hand of a little girl, and the one that was always so shy simply fell to the ground, and in time, of course, it rotted. But the other one that had, you know, lots of imagination and excitement and hope for better things in peanut dome, thought the trip very exciting, through the stomach and so on, through the blood vessels, into the eye, and here a whole new world, you know, opened up. But through a modern parable, I mean, it sounds like nonsense, but you can't, they're too long, they may be like 3 minutes, too much too long for the sermon, they would detract from it. But I've had so much fun developing the thought of a modern parable.
Very good.
And doing it every Sunday is...
That shows imagination, but you've taken quite a task on yourself, too.
You know, another thing, idea along that line that I haven't seen any, only in one place, it was in a liturgy developed at the University of Wisconsin, was they had an old, you listen to the Old Testament witness, you listen to Jesus in the Gospel, you listen to the people around him in the epistle, but why not a reading from a contemporary Christian? They have a reading in their liturgy every week that's taken someplace from some significant reading that sort of informs, that's listening to somebody who's really had something significant to say.
Isn't this possible in the sermon to use a portion of that?
Yeah. You could do that.
See, rather than as if
that's
that
a
were
good
apart
idea.
From that.
Very good.
Yeah.
One thing I've done occasionally, which seems to be appreciated in reading the lesson, is introduce it with a few words as to what the background is. Because so often the Old Testament doesn't really mean too much unless you give a little bit of background for it. Sometimes the epistle. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the gospel. Mm-hmm. How long do you preach?
20 to 25 minutes. There are occasions when it'll be half hour, but not very often. I find it difficult to complete an idea in 10 minutes, 12 minutes. In Mount Olivet, the young adult preached 11 minutes, 10, 11 minutes.
They preach much shorter now than you used to?
About the same, I think. In Eau Claire, I preached the shorter sermons, 15 minutes. But now it's usually 30, 25, never goes beyond 30. Unless it's a special occasion. I give many speeches where I speak an hour. I spoke at the Mortician's Convention for an hour and 10 minutes.
I was thinking what Paul said in criticizing a sermon. I think what stands out here is it's really asking a man to change his life and his patterns and his attitudes. Building his life around sermons, and it isn't
an idea. I don't want to go in and say, all right, Pastor, here, how you write a sermon, how are you going to present it? But I think that maybe you offer, I think a pastor just as human as anybody else can get into a rut. And he forgets that he's in this rut. Right? It's a habit more than anything else. Tonight. And maybe, maybe that is true. Then you go back on a sermon last time, you think about it, and you say, well, maybe I did. But not exactly going in and saying, this is how you should do it, but saying, well, this is what I thought. For instance, going into the pastor and saying, well, this is what I got out of it. Well, maybe this wasn't what he was going to present.
It's always easiest to take negative criticism from someone who first has pointed out, who has also noted something good.
I think the two have to go together. If you're going to say anything negative, be sure it's preceded by something positive.
Sure. I'm too tactfully and all this, but the thing is that I know I've done this with my own dad. I'll say, well, we'll get into discussion of the sermon, and we'll discuss the idea, the main idea that he had, and then we'll go from there and we'll say, well, you know, there's something that I lost. And we'll get it into the conversation as such. And then I don't know, you'll probably think it over. I know he does. You'll think it over and think, well, maybe I could have emphasized or spoke with her. Maybe I could have said something more about it. But not, I'm not saying going in and knocking him down.
It seems to me that three types of responses you hear from on sermons. One of them is complete and total silence. That's most common. And the other is my pastor, that was a nice sermon today, you know, from some nice little woman comes up. But the comments that I appreciate is where somebody actually comes to grips, either positively or negatively, with the ideas that were in the sermon, mm-hmm. You know. That doesn't happen very often. And I think most ministers appreciate it, don't they? When people do that?
I think most ministers, as far as I've heard.
Then you know there's some kind of communication taking place. Something's happening, yeah. You know.
You'd be surprised how the Lord can use some of our blunders, though, when we've preached for what we have thought, and it many times has been a very, very lousy sermon. It's been the very thing that a person may have picked up and has been quite critical about, but then God has never forgotten that crazy thing. You know, I mean, it may have been a very bad thing about the sermon, but it brought her to the attention of what you were trying to say during that message, that perhaps it had just watered off, would have never been remembered otherwise. So.
A woman went up to Moody one time when he finished preaching and said, "Do you know, Moody, that you made 6 grammatical errors in your sermon?" He said, "I'm doing the best I can," he said, "with my imperfections." He said, "What are you doing with your perfection?"
Oh, boy.
Oh.
Oh.
You're